There's no better feeling than a personal win. And the State Farm Personal Price Plan can help you do just that. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So, you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So, whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
The following podcast contains some adult language as well as spoilers for the movie Don't Look Up. Hello, this is The Review, a podcast from The Atlantic's culture team about movies, television, and all the things we make to entertain ourselves. I'm David Sims. I'm not, in fact, David Sims. I wish I were David Sims.
Are you?
Would I would be so eloquent, so well.
Oh, shush.
So hirsute, so stylish.
I'm a little hirsute.
He's hirsute.
I am, in fact.
Kind of.
Sophie Gilbert, a staff writer at The Atlantic, and I'm joined today by, spoiler, David Sims.
Hi, Sophie.
Hi, David. And Spencer Kornhaber.
Hello.
Both staff writers on our culture team. How are you both? How is 2022?
Cold.
Yes.
Quite chilly today. Yes. You know, I'm tense and anxious. How are you?
That's my permanent mood board, basically. Mm-hmm. Tense and anxious. But I'm very happy to be here with you both because I believe we have never podded all three of us together before.
Is that true? Okay. Mm-hmm. I guess it's true. Yeah.
And I feel like we're the meanest and the nastiest of the pod crew. So all together, this should be...
I was going to say, consider how much we bitch and gossip on Slack together.
We do.
The first time we are united in pod form. Today, we are here to talk about Don't Look Up, the disaster satire from Adam McKay that came out on Netflix last month. A bit of plot by way of recap, if you haven't seen it or just want a refresher. The premise is dramatic but straightforward. Two astronomers played by Leonardo DiCaprio and Jennifer Lawrence discover a comet will hit Earth in 6 months. They attempt to warn people. They appeal to the White House. They go to the media. Lastly, they appeal to the business people who are hoping to profit from the big ball of minerals headed our way. But people aren't eager to hear their message, and the planet killing comet becomes another culture war football. As it nears Earth, DiCaprio and Lawrence's characters implore people on social media to just look up, while Meryl Streep's president, Janie Orlean, tells her followers to not look up or don't look up, as she has her message goes. It's not the subtlest of metaphors, but then again, it's not supposed to be. The movie's director, Adam McKay, said he was inspired to write the movie by his burgeoning terror about the climate crisis, and then the pandemic happened. And a comedy about even the most obvious of threats failing to stir collective action became suddenly newly relevant. So today, we're here to break down the movie, but also talk about the state of satire and the question of whether our culture has become too depressing, too absurd, too... too lamentable to satirize. So let's talk about the movie. The sort of festival of how it played out has almost become a parody of discourse itself. There were reviews, there were counter reviews, there were takes, there were defenses. There's been a lot of debate about this movie. So David, tell me first, how did you feel when you first saw it? How did you react to it?
I saw this film fairly early, a few months before it came out, because I interviewed Adam McKay. And so I, you know, went to a long lead screening, as they call it. But I emerged, I remember, in a real bummer mood. The movie really kind of rattled me and annoyed, or not annoyed, but like, you know, I was not like, as you might imagine, you'd exit after seeing a new comedy from Adam McKay, like sort of walking out like, oh, that was a good time. You know, I walked out just kind of with like a thundercloud over my head. And I remember.
Were you in a glass cage of emotion?
Yeah, sure. I was. Milk was a bad choice. Yes. I remember I was just kind of like, and it's not even entirely. Well, obviously the film. We're spoiling the film, obviously. The film ends on a down note in many ways. But I kept having this experience watching it where some twist or turn would play out in the film and I would have the knee-jerk thing of like, this is a bit much, or, you know, this is sort of a twist too far for me. This is tough for me to accept even in a satire. And then like another side of my brain would be like, I don't know, like take a look around, like COVID, you know, would sort of just like nudge me with some sort of real world example that would kind of just make both sides of my brain go, anyway. So yeah, so I had a complicated reaction to it when I saw it. And then I was sort of amazed by the way the discourse played out on its release, where sort of an initial wave of mixed reviews and then this kind of anti-critical backlash of like, well, why are you, you know, criticizing a movie that's trying to send a message? And the whole thing, like all online discourses, became kind of exhausting, which is partly what the movie's about.
It's true. I actually thought your interview with Adam McKay was really interesting when he said that the first two thirds of the film was supposed to be entertaining and then the final third was supposed to be sort of like, oh, hammer home the message. Because my experience of it was really the opposite. Like the first two thirds, I was just in panic, like everyone's making bad decisions, freak out. And then by the final third, I was just kind of like nihilist acceptance, like, oh, you know, it's kind of nice, sentimental dinner party at the end.
I do. Yes, I would agree with that completely, actually. Yeah.
Spencer, I was going to ask, did you read any of the reviews, counter takes?
Yeah, I don't know if I sat down and read too much about it, but sort of ambiently absorbed the fact that this was becoming a discourse cyclone and that in general, something weird was happening where film critics were hating this movie, but like liberal commentators were blasting film critics. And that's sort of like a flip of a dynamic that we've seen play out with really big blockbuster movies about superheroes and the Joker and other sort of frivolous subjects, but not about climate change, which is the subject of this movie. So I was ready for it to be like an interesting bad movie, but I think it's kind of like a good movie. It's kind of an extraordinary movie. I don't think it's my favorite movie, but it is accomplishing something that I've never quite seen done before. And well, it made me laugh. It actually made me cry, which shocked me. And it gave me things to think about. And what else do you want with the movies? And we can get into how that works. But I just generally was like, yeah, edge of my seat, interested, amused, annoyed for sure at certain parts. And ended up kind of like watching this on the couch with my boyfriend. And we were trying to not look at each other because I think we were both embarrassed to be having an emotional reaction to the end of this movie.
I didn't cry. I left persuaded more than ever that there is never going to be anything that manages to sway the public to save the world in any meaningful sense. Like, it's just not possible. Mom, we're too stupid. We're too concerned with our own lives. Like, I think it really makes the case that we have evolved past the point of collective action. So in that sense, real bummer of a movie. But I did want to ask you, David, like, why do you think so many of the critics were so turned off by it? Because it really got some pretty scathing reviews from film writers.
I'm going to try and sum up what I feel like were the sort of overall objections I gauged from my community of
yes, please.
Critics. One, the film is 138 minutes long. It is undeniably super bloated. I think it absolutely could have used slightly more focus, I would say, rather than sort of like being like, let's tackle TV media, social media, you know, broken political system. You know, like, it's just sort of trying to do everything at once. And it's like, if I'm watching a satirical comedy, I maybe want it to be like 100 minutes long.
It also tackles skater teens. Don't forget that.
It brings in a lot of ideas. Anyway, you know, so that's certainly a problem. A thing that I think I struggled with watching it and struggled with in retrospect, and the thing that people have written about, is like, I'm not sure. I understand why McKay picked this metaphor of an asteroid coming to Earth, partly because it's a familiar Hollywood tale. There's lots of, you know, there's Armageddon, there's Deep, you know, there are movies that you can satirize and have the audience know, like, yeah, we know how this usually goes. The president gets people together. There's astronaut, right? You know, like, we know the tropes of a meteor coming to Earth story. I don't know if the metaphor ever cleanly tracked for me in a movie that's obviously trying to be highly metaphorical, because climate change is hard to see and hard to, you know, point to and hard to like distill into something that people can focus on is something to tackle, whereas the meteor is literally the opposite of that.
We're trying to tell you that the entire planet is about to be destroyed.
Okay.
Well, it's, you know, just something we do around here. You know, we just keep the bad news light.
I think the interesting thing with this movie is everyone's kind of assessing it on different grounds. Like, there are the people who are assessing it as a film, and then there are the people who are like, how dare you assess this as a work of film? It's a primal scream about the state of, you know, our inaction in this face of the threat that is dooming us all. I think one of the things that it speaks to is, like, there just isn't that much film and television and popular culture about the climate crisis. I think in fiction, there's more in literature. There's a genre called cli-fi, which is sort of like post-apocalyptic climate
fiction.
That's
pretty recent. Yeah. But it's certainly happening, yeah, in literature.
The only other example I can really think of in film is Mother, Darren Aronofsky's movie, also with Jennifer Lawrence, that was just wacky as hell and also extremely divisive.
There's lots of films that have backgrounded some sort of climate apocalypse, like Snowpiercer, Day After Tomorrow. There was this awful movie last year called Reminiscence, starring Hugh Jackman, that was set in like a flooded earth. But like, it's usually sort of like, you know, it's post-apocalypse and it's just kind of like, yep, well, that happened and now earth looks cool and different in some weird way, like Waterworld, whatever, you know, any kind of, yeah.
But it's not like mid-apocalyptic primal scream, which I think Mother in some ways felt a little bit like if you were reading it on that level. So because there just isn't that much of this kind of movie, I think the expectations placed on it and certainly like the different readings placed on it were higher than any one thing can bear.
I mean, it's supposed to be a movie that saves the world, according to the discourse, and I don't think that's absolutely not an okay expectation to have for any work of fiction. But to be fair, I think the way that McKay has talked about this movie kind of makes it seem like he did want to save the world with this movie. Did you get that sense talking to him, David?
I get the sense that Adam McKay thinks that things are very dire and the climate emergency is going to accelerate faster than even predicted. And so certainly he's, you know, on the battlements trying to sound an alarm. But I mean, he is obviously an entertainer. That is his stock and trade. So like, you know, he's not making an inconvenient truth. He's not making a movie where he's just standing in front of a PowerPoint, like trying to tell you the details of this.
But that kind of is what The Big Short was.
Well, look, his last sort of out and out comedy, his last movie he made with Will Ferrell, The Other Guys, ended with these credits that rolled over like a sort of, like PowerPoint-y series of graphs about the financial crisis, right? And everyone was sort of like, what? You know, like, because the pension fund machinations were sort of a background story in that movie, and people, I remember, walked out of the movie being like, that was funny. What was with the end there? And like, you know, since then, yes, McKay has shifted to a more polemical style of filmmaking that is grappling with real world stuff. And, you know, he made The Big Short, he made Vice. Now he's made this. Succession, obviously, is he directed the pilot of that. So, yes, I mean, he's certainly, I remember when I interviewed Bong Joon-ho a few years ago, Bong said that like McKay is one of his favorite American filmmakers, but you know, Bong also makes these movies that are like, you know, straight at the camera, current event sort of satire. Like that's the kind of stuff that I called it agitprop in my review. I mean, you know, like, right, like that's kind of what he's doing right now. And I guess the question and the thing we talked about is that how do you balance that with entertainment, right? Like how do you get your big message across while also keeping the audience hooked, you know, and he's got movie stars and he's got twists and turns and special, you know, like, you know, try to, you know, throw all that together in a blender.
But it's also kind of like, how do you balance advocacy and satire? Because satire, I think, exposes and advocacy provokes. And this film works as very brutal satire in the sense that it really does, or certainly made me feel that the world is too fucked to save itself, you know, and that everything, colluding all the forces of business and Silicon Valley and media and entertainment, is sort of distracting people from the fundamental crisis at the heart of the movie. But I think the movie kind of dooms itself on that front too, because it's asking you to pay attention, but it's telling you that it won't matter.
What you're saying is like, how do you also balance advocacy and nihilism? Because there is a certain level of nihilism that comes with talking about the climate crisis that is hard to avoid. And obviously, I think McKay knows that he's making an asteroid movie. These movies usually end with some sort of triumph. And he knows, like, it would be ridiculous for him to end the movie on a high note, because that would sort of undercut his message of, like, we can, you know, if we all just get together. Like, that's not what this movie's about. So he has to end it on the bummer note. And that's a tough thing to ask of a, you know, star-studded mainstream comedy that's premiering on Netflix at Christmas time, right? Like, it's a big thing.
With Meryl Streep with a tramp stamp.
You cannot go around saying to people that there's 100% chance that they're going to die. You know, it's just nuts.
David, I wanted to ask you about tone, because it's just such a tricky tone to nail. Do you think there's a version of this that someone else could have done, a different director, or a version of this that was like slightly differently balanced that could have worked better?
Yeah, I mean, you could make the more straight ahead, you know, blockbuster movie, I suppose, like that is just tinged with metaphor, you know, so it's more of like a Michael Bay movie about blowing up an asteroid, but there's just this sort of like, oh, if you look past this a little bit, like this is actually sort of a movie about the failure of American institutions, which actually a lot of Michael Bay movies are about, in my opinion, but that's another discussion. But I think the thing that this flirts with being but does not completely commit to being is more like a Doctor Strangelove type movie that is pure anarchic satire, right? Like that is, yes, set in the real world, but like every character is cartoonish and there's much more nihilism. There's like no sense of humanity whatsoever. Like what Don't Look Up is trying to retain is this core of humanity, especially in the Leo and Jennifer Lawrence's characters. And I mean, like when I interviewed McKay, he said DiCaprio was obviously interested in like the project and like the message or whatever, but like was not going to commit until they sort of like drilled down and like figured out the character. Like he clearly did not want to just be in like a sort of cartoony pastiche movie. And McKay also told me that like his editor said like, oh, this is like the trickiest movie I've ever edited with you. The tone is so difficult to nail, like, you know, right, because it's just sort of swerving from, you know, bleakness to silliness to realism, you know, like it's a sort of staggering challenge to try and contain everything and such a big ensemble and so, you know, so many twists and turns. So that's where things about it didn't click for me. But then that's where, like you said, Sophie, the last act of the movie actually worked for me really well, as it sort of starts to abandon the more cartoony stuff and the kind of media critiques and all that, and sort of become more of a character movie set at, like, you know, the last days of planet Earth. I love Adam McKay. Like, I'm a very fierce defender of his comedy stuff and all that. You know, I don't know where his career goes from. He's making a movie about Elizabeth Holmes next. Like, he's staying in the sort of real world critiques. This definitely is just sort of like a very grand, ambitious work that you have to admire the ambition, I think, even if you don't admire the end product.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about the arc of his career a bit, because he talked about wanting to move on from Oh Fish White Guys, like the products of his earliest films, because they stopped being funny. And I don't know it's they stopped being funny necessarily. I think they're in many ways as funny as they've ever been, but I think it's that he almost made them too lovable. Do you know what I mean?
Yes,
like the dunces
absolutely.
Of right. Anchorman and Talladega Nights, where you're really finding charm in something that the later years turned out were actually not so charming.
David, I mean, your interview with him, yeah, he says that that felt like a Bush era thing. And now in the Trump era, we've seen just like how awful these characters are, and they shouldn't be lovable. And it makes me think of people like, for example, Kanye West, who is obsessed with Step Brothers and other Adam McKay
Wait, is
films.
He really?
Oh yeah, no, oh, yeah. He's like
always dropping samples. Right?
Uh-huh. Yeah. And it's like these movies are making fun of the kind of grandiosity and silliness that he conducts himself with, like people like him conduct themselves with, and yet he thinks that they're just lovable and hilarious and relatable. And so that's, you know, it's that classic thing that I think Michael Lewis talked about when he did he wrote Liar's Poker, and he started hearing from all these stockbroker bros who love the book and just wanted to learn more about how to be like the people describing the book. You know, like
right,
this is
a map to success. This is great. Right. It's a good book.
I mean, that is the trick. That is the tough thing with satire. Like, you actually create these kind of like metaphors and images that get repurposed by the people you're trying to take down.
Well, yeah, I mean, one of the only... McKay and I said, like, I guess Leo's never been in an out-and-out comedy before. And McKay was like, that's basically true, but I would say The Wolf of Wall Street is fully a comedy. And I was like, right, it is. Like, and that movie, when it came out, was similarly kind of swamped in this critical discourse thing where people are like, well, this movie is a championing an absolute monster, and like it's 3 hours of him behaving like a pig and like swindling people and, you know, being absolutely horrifying. And of course, you know, the sort of like depiction versus endorsement debate reared its ugly head, because of course there are going to be people who watch a movie like that and go like, well, this guy's the best, how do I be like him? But that doesn't mean the movie isn't like trying to lay bare the absolute, you know, uber masculine horror of the world. He's, you know, like, you know, like that. It's what's interesting about satirical movie making, right? Like, and that's the thing about A Talladega Nights, which I think is like this brilliant Bush era comedy. You know, obviously it's making fun of that kind of like swaggering white male mediocrity of the time, you know, and he, you know, Will Ferrell's character is an absolute doofus, but also you do kind of love him, right? You do kind of, you know, want him to win. You want him to beat the mean French guy. You want him to get the girl. Like, you know, it's a movie. You're gonna glom on to that kind of narrative.
Yeah, I mean, it makes me think about Don't Look Up, and you know, maybe that is the change that he made for this movie that's making it kind of land strangely. I mean, do you love any of these characters? Does anyone want to be Jonah Hill or Leo DiCaprio or anyone this week? I don't know. Like, everyone is kind of just sad.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. There's not a ton of heart in it, really, until the end.
Right.
Though I did truly love Cate Blanchett's character. She's just such a brilliant pastiche of the kind of person who acts dumb on TV when they're actually ferociously smart, and they're so ferociously smart that they know how far playing dumb can get them.
Well, the handsome astronomer can come back anytime, but the yelling lady, not so much.
Not so much.
Spectrum Business works with small businesses nationwide, so we know that running your own business means doing it all. Marketing, sales, inventory, customer service, and more. Spectrum One for Business helps you keep it all connected for just $49.99 a month. Get fast, reliable internet, advanced Wi-Fi with security shield, and a free mobile line for one low price. Stay connected and do it all with Spectrum One for Business. Only $49.99 a month. Go to spectrum.com/business to learn more. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Is there any other filmmaker who could assemble this kind of cast now? I mean, it's just stacked. Like Meryl Streep, Cate Blanchett, Jennifer Lawrence, Leonardo DiCaprio, and then Mark Rylance. That actually was, strangely enough, it is the Mark Rylance performance that did not work for me.
He's doing his sort of Ready Player One kind of like guy who seems to have one foot in another dimension, sort of, you know, like airy, you know, kind of voice.
I mean, it's of a piece with the other caricatures in this movie, which is just generally in the direction of making people seem flaky and absent rather than like actively malevolent. But I did think one of the funniest parts of this movie was when Rylance is giving his presentation about new technology and he has children up there as props. One of the children asks if they can speak, and he just very matter-of-factly says, no.
As we all should.
May I say something, Mr. Ritual?
No.
I wanted to ask you guys, what do you think worked best in the film? I think for me, it was Meryl Streep's character, Jonah Hill, playing her son, who I think said, he based his character on the question, what if Firefest was a person, and what if that person had power inside the White House?
Sort of, right, Kushner on steroid type character.
But dumber and so much trollier. What worked best for you guys?
I mean, I absolutely agree that the presidential duo of Meryl and Jonah, they are the funniest thing and also the sharpest critique. Just starting with the gag of the president making the scientists who know about the end of the world wait for a full day, like in the lobby outside the Oval Office, like, and then when they meet her, she's not a full idiot. She's just kind of distracted and looking for a way to not turn this into a huge issue. But then there's that moment that I love where Leo is sort of having a meltdown.
You do understand that this is an apocalyptic event. This is a large celestial body heading towards our planet at speeds that
even... I hear you.
Then at that point, President Orlean realizes that she has to change the political tool she's using, and she like looks him straight in the eye and she says, "Oh, we're taking this very seriously. Don't worry." And it's just like she knows, because she is that good of a sociopathic manipulator, like how to kind of diffuse that situation in the room, but doesn't go on to do anything about it.
See, I don't love Meryl and Jonah. That's I'm not with you guys. I could not drill down to what Meryl was doing. I didn't really get what the satire was. I mean, Jonah, I understood what the satire was. That was obvious. He's fine. He's sort of doing what's asked of him. But like, those were the scenes where I actually kind of was zoning out the most, I will admit.
Do we want to talk about Ariana Grande, Spencer?
Oh, Ariana Grande is one of the better parts of the movie. Less when she's like speaking and, you know, failing to really convey too much as an actor. And less when, you know, I hate the name of her character, Riley Bina. It's not like a mellifluous pop star name at all to me. But one of the best scenes is the benefit concert that happens kind of at the midpoint of the movie, just, you know, to tell everyone to look up and listen to scientists. And it's just a perfect replication of the sort of benefit concert pop star vibes that you get, where Ariana Grande is, she looks stunning. She has like these beautiful sculptural pigtails, and she's wearing this dress that kind of makes her look like a snowflake. And, you know, her song sounds a lot like Whitney Houston, The Greatest Love of All. It's just this like kind of like soaring, treacly thing. And there's like this hilarious disconnect in the idea that like this performance is going to do anything to stop a comet from hitting the Earth. Like, and she's singing to this arena full of people holding up their lighters, like, "Wake up, we're all going to die." And it's just, it's just, that's exactly how it would go. Like, there, we would have a concert like that. Ariana Grande would probably be there. She would probably look as good as she does there. She would sing as well as she does there. And it wouldn't mean a damn thing.
"You guys discovered a comet? That's so dope. I have a tattoo of a shooting star on my back."
I did love Ron Perlman shooting at the comet. Because you know there were 7,000% be Americans who did that.
Right.
I was about to say Ron Perlman, I thought, like, seemed like a character that they wanted to have in the movie more, and something about it wasn't working, so they cut. Like it seemed like there was potential there, but he was just a big, dumb military dude, right? Like, that who does, I guess, start calling out various, like, lightly racist and bigoted things as he's piloting the rocket. That was a funny gag.
"And a big hello to that beautiful blue ball down there we all call home. All those proud white folks working hard."
Yeah, let's be real. He'd really be president in our reality. Sorry, Meryl.
Yeah, absolutely.
I do kind of connect to Leo's character, not as like someone I'm like, "Oh, I'm like this guy," you know, but I just found the arc of him being celebrity-fied, you know, like being this sort of like introverted scientist type who's just trying to get a message across, and then like who becomes a sort of Fauci-esque matter of debate in the middle of the movie, where people are like, "Oh, he's so dreamy," or "Oh, he's a liar," you know, like the weird way that our culture can only process people as celebrities now.
Yeah.
Even when they are not striving particularly to be celebrities, you know, like I found that to be one of the most effective bits of sort of commentary in this movie. I think, I personally think a lot of what works about this movie works because of him. I think he is giving an extremely committed performance that would not, like, this movie would sort of like not have a center without him. Like, I found some of the media stuff a little broad. Like, I don't think there's any show, like any morning show like the one in this, that would have such an absolute cultural lodestone quality, but like, you know, but there were things like that I felt were,
but also morning television, you know, is a strange thing to point a finger at when all of basically right-wing media and the internet's minefield of disinformation exists. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's weird that with all that at your disposal, you're like, "But Hoda," you know, not to single out Hoda, she does God's work.
She does. I mean, to me the media stuff felt the most dated and predictable. But I then again, as a member of the media, it's just, I hear myself sounding very predictable when I complain about the portrayal of the media. Like no movie makes me happy when you have a journalist being like, oh, well, I don't want the story to be clickbait, so I'm not going to use the word engorged or whatever Jennifer Lawrence's journalist boyfriend says towards the beginning of the movie. Like things like that are just, to me, feel like a filmmaker who is annoyed at bad reviews he's gotten before, but I guess it fits with the public perception of how the media is. I think the dissonance with the media stuff too also like speaks to the way that the comet doesn't work as a metaphor for climate change. You know, media right. loves negativity, loves the apocalypse. Like if there's a big asteroid heading towards Earth, there's no way that it's not like bleeds leads kind of front page news immediately, totally histrionic, totally unhelpful probably, but it's just not the way that climate change works. It's not something that's going to affect us in a world-destroying way in the next 6 months, though, you know,
right, yeah.
The movement has admirably tried to create like this sort of sense of deadlines and metrics that we are going to tip over and then we'll be past a certain point of no return. Like, and that's been a somewhat effective strategy, but that's not the same thing as an asteroid. And so it just doesn't ring true that this news would be ignored. It's a little bit more like COVID to me. What did Adam say about the COVID stuff with regards to this movie?
That was what interested me most in talking to him. I was like, you wrote this movie as one sort of specific metaphor. And then as you're getting ready to make it, you have to shut down because of another sort of apocalyptic moment in culture that then ends up kind of proving so much of your critique unintentionally, right? Like, you know, that is sort of what's wild about this film. And he agreed that it was a crazy sort of circumstance. And as he was in lockdown, you know, like everyone else, he sort of went back to the script and had to intensify some of the satire, like had to make the wackiness quotient of Don't Look Up even higher to sort of eclipse moments like, you know, Trump floating, you know, injecting bleach on national TV or what, you know, like things like that, where he was like, this is too ludicrous and yet it's played out. So like, I need to try and match the absurdity of that, like something like that, that was all very interesting to me. Like, but it also does reflect what's difficult about satire right now, where it's like, how do you find ludicrousness in our ludicrous reality, right? Or like, I don't know how else to put it. Does that make sense? Like, how do you heighten and amuse when everything is already feels so heightened all the time?
The idea that sort of Trump defied satire because he was bigger than it could ever manage to be in its leaps of wildest imagination. I also think it's really hard to satirize things when you're in the middle of them. I think often you need distance.
Sure. Right.
And the climate crisis is a tricky one for that, because we're going to be in the middle of it now until we all die. So there's no like nice relaxed alpha phase to kind of really digest this, in the sense that maybe there will with a Trump presidency in a decade or so or something like that. But it just seems tricky in this moment for entertainment to tackle these really big issues.
You know, the difficulty of the Iraq War movie, that was something that was sort of much discussed in the 2000s, right? It's like, we're in Iraq. This is such a big news topic. Obviously, it's like a major thing that's happening to America. Why can't we make movies that resonate about it, right? Like, you know, there were so many movies that flopped that were about the Iraq War and about like modern warfare in general. And like eventually something like The Hurt Locker, that finally, even though that wasn't like a huge, huge hit, but that won an Oscar and it was, you know, it was a big, memorable movie.
Yeah.
But like the struggle with the Iraq War, depicting the Iraq War in art, is the same as the struggle with climate change, where it's like, it's a very, very futile endeavor. Like, it's very, very difficult to turn that into something entertaining, because almost every Iraq War movie was sort of just about like, we're stuck, we don't know what we're doing, the enemy is oblique, like the purpose is sort of vague, you know, it was just impossible to put a heroic narrative onto it. And obviously that's something like Vietnam War movies had trouble with too. Like, the Vietnam movie sort of became more of a thing post Vietnam, like after we were out of the war and there was more reflection, and like, so that's sort of something that's happening with the Iraq War movie, probably. It's just going to be hard to do that with climate change, because it's, again, it's like, you can't just make a simple movie about scientists saving the world. Like, it's not going to reflect the reality.
Well, I think this quest for like movies that try to deliver the message or the argument that will really shift the discourse and change people's minds is maybe quixotic or futile. It's not, there's not like a ton of movies or works of any kind in history
right.
that
it's not
you
what
can
it's
kind of
to
squarely
do.
Point to. But what they do is give you a set of like images and characters and metaphors and cliches that sort of become, like when they work, they become absorbed into our language and they help us kind of talk about the world in ways that are hopefully progressing our discourse and society away from the bad stuff. You know, it's really tricky. You know, you think about like, I mean, The Matrix, like that's a movie about trying to wake the public up, and it gives you the metaphor of the red pill and the blue pill. And that's a very powerful metaphor that's being used in politics today, but it's not really being used in the way the filmmakers intended.
Well, yeah, that's an old movie, Spencer. I know, I hate to break it to you. That movie's 23 years old.
You know, okay, I mean, you know what, Veep? Like, we love Veep.
I think of Jordan Peele right away, like, as sort of like one of the more interesting metaphorical, like, guys, like, both Get Out and Us, to me, had, like, a very mm-hmm. strong metaphor delivered very punchily. Like, yeah. you know, Get Out had the sunken place as this sort of, like, thing you could read a lot of contemporary observation into, right? Like, you know, how Black people are marginalized or forced to, you know, sublimate parts of themselves, things like that. And then Us, which I think is still like wildly underrated, is like one of the best pieces of satire, I think, of Hollywood in like recent years about like how, you know, capitalist society works, where there's so much that you just have to ignore. Like, you know, because if I can spoil Us for a second, sorry, mm-hmm. this is an Us rant, but spoilers for Us if you've not seen Us, but like the whole point of Us is that there's like a subterranean society of duplicates who like work beneath us, like, you know, sort of mirroring our activities. And I remember when that movie came out, people were like, well, this is ridiculous. This is we would know if there were like escalators leading underneath the earth, like to another world. And it's like, the whole point of Us is that we try to ignore things that horrify us because, like, we, you know, it's too staggering to think about. Like, there is, you know, entire underclasses and entire marginalized societies that we just, you know, you can't process these things on a day to day because you would go crazy. Sorry. Anyway, so yeah, Jordan Peele, that's my answer.
Us, yeah, good movie. But I think you're right that it's just like a wonderful distillation of how the world works, and it is underrated because we kind of know how the world works. And so like, right. like when a movie works on that level, it can only go so far. But thinking about like Get Out, I think it made a lot of, you know, white people check themselves about whether they're the character in that movie. And sure. So similarly, like
Obama
with
three times, right.
Yeah. With Don't Look Up, I think one of the things that maybe might work about it is, you know, you can't really satirize Trump. It's true. He's kind of beyond parody, but you can call attention to the dynamics of the way that people relate to him and the effect he has on the world around him and on the viewer themselves. And so maybe this isn't going to work, but I liked the moment when Jennifer Lawrence's character goes back to her parents and her parents say, you can't come in the house unless you agree not to talk about politics. And not talking about politics means not talking about the comet, which is like
right.
Nuts, but it's like, you know, maybe there will be
politics,
viewers who will
unquote.
See this movie and hear their own language and check themselves. Maybe not. Maybe that won't work. But like, that's kind of maybe the greatest hope for any movie like this, is that it makes certain kinds of people who are pretty entrenched in their own belief systems just like take a step back.
No politics. None.
What are you talking about?
Your dad and I are for the jobs the comet will provide.
The divisions in this country are bad enough. We don't want more of that in our house.
Yeah. I just wanted to make the case, too, for Orange is the New Black as a piece of art that functioned really well as a political critique, but it wasn't its primary function. Like, it was definitely there to entertain, but at the same time, it told you these stories. I mean, it really made the case that the carceral system is flawed beyond repair, and I think adapted to the reality of the Trump presidency by the end to really comment on the immigration system at the same time. And it did it while being extremely funny and extremely well written. I mean, not always perfect, as no show is, but I think it did something that, as one of the really earliest Netflix products, it had a tremendous impact that I don't know that we've all really processed.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
The thing with Don't Look Up and the sort of rare movie of this ilk is like, of course, movies can change minds and, you know, art can have great power in that way. But like, when your movie is so explicitly designed to do that, It's sort of trying to pass a different sort of a test, right? Like, it's more like, can this obvious piece of polemic like also function as entertainment, right? Like, that's sort of the difficult challenge. satirizing Trump. Not that this movie specifically trying to set, that's not like this movie, I feel like, is more trying to satirize like a general cultural mindset, right? Like, why is it that we are not thinking about this existential crisis that is around us in every, like, you know, why is it we're distracting ourselves? And like, that's to me a very interesting thing to grapple with. I don't know how you satirize Trump without just sort of getting lost in cartoonishness. And I don't think McKay knows either. I think when he was making comedy in the Bush era, he absolutely understood that sort of American mindset. He absolutely understood how to puncture it and how to make it silly and pathetic and sympathetic. Like, you know, that's what's so brilliant about Anchorman and Talladega Nights and Step Brothers. And he wisely, I think, is looking at the current political moment and is like, I don't know how to make that funny. Like, so I will comment it from the side, talking about the climate crisis or the financial crisis.
You both have mentioned distraction. And I think if there is something that slightly rubs me the wrong way about this movie, it's the way it targets the great masses for being distracted. When really, like, distraction is what we do to survive. No one can live in a state of profound fear, existential anxiety, panic, depression, unhappiness, stress all the time. Like, distraction, including by watching Netflix movies, is what gives us moments of relief, you know, not always, not exclusively, but, and obviously it's all about balance and we do have to pay attention to the things that matter, but simple distraction by itself is worth defending, I think.
I mean, that was, McKay and I talked about, like, look, McKay and I are both invested in the fact that Ben Affleck is dating Jennifer Lopez again. We both admitted a certain sort of, oh, it's nostalgic and oh, it's sort of funny to think about, you know, like, but like at the same time, McKay's like, but this is a distraction. We can't be thinking about it. He was just allowing that. Of course I think about it too. It's not like I am some noble holy warrior who spends every minute, you know, worrying about climate change. Like, I understand that it's easy to glom on to more fun, more frivolous things. And like, so that's why this movie is trying to mix frivolity and the fun of a Hollywood blockbuster disaster movie with a message. It's just about how that goes over. I've heard from family members, you know, friends of family or family friends or whatever, some people being like, well, that was good, and not thinking really about any broader metaphor at all, just sort of thinking about it on its own terms. And obviously, then there's the other side of people being like, how can you criticize a movie that is so noble-minded in trying to change minds? Like, you know, any film, no matter how direct its messages, is going to be interpreted different ways. Once it's out in the world, you know, it's just going to be in the eye of the beholder.
All right, I think we can land the rocket ship of nukes there. But before we go, we have talked a lot about Adam McKay. And so I wanted to ask you both what your favorite McKay movies were and why. And I will say that mine is Step Brothers, mostly because every day, at least three times a day, I say that immortal Catherine Hahn line, which is, I hate my life, Dale.
I think what's brilliant about Step Brothers is the challenge of it, of like, can we have as little plot as possible and still connect emotional dots for an audience, right? Like the plot of Step Brothers is barely there. They're stepbrothers. And you're like, oh, okay. And they're like, yeah, that's all we've got. We're going to see how this goes. And then there's all these sort of like weird little plots on the margin that are so funny. It's, you know, like Dadaist comedy almost. Mm-hmm. It's Step Brothers is a work of genius. I love Talladega Nights. I really think Talladega Nights is like the definitive piece of Bush era comedy. Like, that is a movie I can watch again and again and again. Like, the hilarious obtuseness of those characters and the triumphant mediocrity. Like, I always love the scene where, you know, the guy brags about like, well, we invented missionary sex, so you're welcome. You know, like that whole mindset of like triumphant normality. It's such a funny movie, and it is also like a relatively straightforward like sports movie that you can like enjoy, you know, the sort of like act breaks of. You know, Talladega is my favorite, but I love all those McKay comedies.
So do I have to speak up for Anchorman? Like that's my
Anchorman
job,
rules.
The basic one. Like, you know, it became kind of uncool to like Anchorman for a while. It was kind of like that and Borat were like ones that had been overly quoted to death and like associated with a certain kind of frat dude maybe. But I think we've come back around to just that is a movie that is as far from reality as you could possibly imagine, and yet is absolutely nailing like a kind of media environment, kind of person, kind of obliviousness, kind of relationship, kind of era. And it also changed the way that I think about the city of San Diego forever. So yeah, Anchorman is my Adam McKay movie.
Definitely.
That does it for the show. The Review is produced by Kevin Townsend with help from AC Valdez, and we'd like to welcome the new executive producer of Atlantic Podcasts, Claudine Abade. Our art is by Charlie Le Mignon. I'm Sophie Gilbert. Thank you, Spencer.
Thanks, Sophie.
Thank you, David.
Thank you, Sophie.
See you guys next time.
Bye.